Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And if you're wondering what it takes to get to the top, we're going to look at that on this episode. And I've done a lot of research. I've interviewed hundreds of executives, if not thousands. And I can tell you it's not IQ, it's not intelligence, because there are numerous geniuses who die broke. And it's not talent, because talent alone will not get you there. And after interviewing hundreds of self-made millionaires and a few self-made billionaires, I have failed to find some superhuman genius or elusive gifted talent. Instead, I usually find a person who has endured failure after failure. Success is literally that person who lies homeless on the floor, bankrupt, only to find the courage and strength to rise up one last time. Because success is simply defined as getting up one more time than you've been knocked down. So if you're experiencing failure, if you just got fired from your job, if you got passed up for your promotion, if you're experiencing some calamity in your life, I would like to congratulate you, because the seeds of your success have just been planted. In your darkest moments, the seeds of your finest hour are planted. These are your moments. This is where you will draw your strength from. This is your moment. It's time to make the rest of your life the best of your life, because the flavor of life is not in the tasting. It's in the hunger. And I can tell you, our first guest is full of hunger. Her name is Ramona Fazeli. She's the founder of Malkistan Consulting. She has a passion for fashion. Ramona, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you for having me.
And happy Halloween.
Oh, thanks.
So it's quite exciting to have you here. You made it. I think there was a bit of traffic.
Yeah, it was a bit of traffic in Sheikh Zayed Road, as usual. Nothing surprising, but I should have pre-planned it. I got here.
Well, that's the
finally.
Beauty. That's the beauty of Dubai now. The place is just bursting at the seams. You have traffic on all the main roads, and cranes are littering the horizon again, which is beautiful sight. You know, I think is really a lot of signs of a great economy.
Not only a great economy, I have a beautiful view from my apartment, and every day, and actually every night, I look out there, and it's fascinating. The vibe of the city is just fascinating, and you just want to get out there and make it happen.
So are you looking at the traffic jams and the cranes, or are you facing the ocean?
I'm actually looking at both sides, because I'm on the 54th floor, so
okay.
It's quite nice.
So you're right up there at the
exactly.
At the top. It's fantastic. So, what is fashion? I mean, you're a specialist in the premium luxury segment,
yes.
And is that a bit of an indicator of the economy, or is it more immune? I mean, do people buy? It must be tied to the economy. I mean, you must see a huge increase as the economy picks up. And is it basically drop off when the economy slows?
Of course. I think in any sector you will see slowdowns or going up. But in terms of luxury, when we all remember 2009, the recession that hit not only the world but also Dubai, this was quite visible also in terms of job and structure. A lot of things where a lot of people were laid off, a lot of people in the luxury industry had to do extra things. For instance, a brand manager had to be also project manager, a lawyer at the same time, just because the economy was slower and companies could not afford to hire new people. So as a result, yes, luxury is not immune, but nevertheless, you will always have this percentage of luxury customers who are well-planned, and they are just more aware now what to spend and where to spend it for. They are not very easy anymore. Before 2009, people would just come and spend. Today, they are more conscious. They know what they want. They know how they want to spend the money. And when you look at the Dubai retail market, for instance, where we always love to welcome the Russian customers, and today we see a slowdown, for instance, because of what's happening in Russia and the sanctions. So you see it, you feel it also in the luxury sector, that it's very much linked not only to economics but also into the political situations.
Well, you know what's interesting is when you see some people think that because an item is designer and it's very expensive, that it actually looks good on.
Yes.
And then they buy a whole outfit of these designer items that don't go together, but they're like thinking that because it's designer, it's cool, and it's just totally not.
Yeah, that's the power of a brand, I would say. And that's why companies spend so much money on building their brands. It's because no matter what it is, if you have the logo of the brand on it, you will sell it. But today also, we have to be fair, the customers are quite well educated. They know how to combine things. They know how to put an outfit together. And I think this is also thanks to a broad social media presence at the moment.
A broad social media presence,
yes,
has given them a better sense
of
fashion.
Of course. You are becoming part of the fashion world instantly. It's like Instagram at the moment is like a small New York, I always say. You become part of the fashion week. You think you're front row. You just see people, how they dress. It's becoming more accessible. You have an insight into the life of the fashion people, of fashion week, of fashion, of the life of the fashion professionals as well.
This is so basically on the catwalk you're getting pictures of what,
yes,
these
videos at the moment as well.
Okay, but I mean, seriously, I have never been to a fashion show or seen them wear anything that a regular human would wear. So when you're looking
it's
at
changing,
these catwalks,
changing.
I mean, it's like some bizarre psycho thing from a B science thriller movie that they put up there.
Yeah, but you know that fashion shows are not meant to sell, actually. The fashion show is just for the image, because the actual collection you buy 3 months before. So it's called the main collection, where it's 80% of the collection of the designer. The fashion show comprises only 20% of what's being sold, and it's just an image. It's a window, basically, for the world to see the inspiration and the image of the designer. But they are not necessarily commercial. But again, through social media, I have to emphasize that all those fashion show pieces are becoming must-haves as well.
Must-haves.
Yes.
Must have.
I have even a good example. There is a Chanel bag that looks like a milk bottle, and it's funny because when you see it on the catwalk, you would think, I would never buy that, but they actually have a waiting list for that bag.
For the milk bottle bag.
Yes, exactly. So it's called Lady Coco. So
Lady Coco.
Le de Coco. So it's milk of cocoa. So it's a. I know, it's very hard for a man to understand, but all the women out there will understand me, and I'm sure they all know the back.
Yes. So you originally grew up in, born in Tehran, moved to Germany.
Yes.
And you were going to be a lawyer.
Yes, that was the idea. That was my parents' plan. And looking back, I think they had a good plan, actually, because I love law. I deal a lot with contracts right now, and I read a lot of contracts, and I love it. And I somehow am happy that I studied law for a year. But I think it was one day when I was just waiting to get out of the university to go shopping, because my passion was always fashion, like all the other women. And so I had to convince my parents that law wasn't ultimately for me, and I wanted to do something else. It was not really easy to, to convince, not even Iranian parents, because my mom, she grew up in Germany, and my dad studied and grew up in Washington. So they are quite open-minded, but I think the Iranian roots will always remain. So being a lawyer or a doctor is always more preferred than to go into the fashion business. But I could convince them. I went to university and became a textile engineer. So I had still the engineering title, which was good for them. They were happy. My daughter is an engineer. And then I did my master's on trade and marketing. So just to bring a bit of a business case in it.
Okay, so you did the big switch, gave your parents a heart attack.
Yes.
And then it was into the luxury fashion industry.
Yes, and I think today because I deal with a lot of young people who are not sure what they want to do, and they're always afraid because there's the expectation from the society of what you have to do and what you want to do. And it always, I mean, maybe you want to be a filmmaker, but you will never be able, especially on this part of the world, it's not something that, okay, your parents will always tell you, but how do you want to live? It's not going to pay your bills, basically. A fashion designer, a filmmaker, all those artistic things are always a bit questionable if you're a parent. But I would like to encourage people to actually do what they really want to do, because then you give 100%. When I was studying law, I wasn't giving 100%, so I wouldn't have become the best lawyer. When I decided to do what I wanted to do, I gave 100% and I worked extra. So.
Yeah, but the thing is even like a bad lawyer makes a lot of money.
You think so?
They actually did a study and they were trying to find out, you know, what was the best predictor for salary or for
yes.
best compensation. And they found that performance only accounts for 5 to 8% of your actual income.
Wow.
So, and that means that a poorly performing CEO can actually make a significantly more money than a high performing CEO.
Wow, and that's a good study. I should go back to Loda.
Of course, so it's not performing. And then they said, okay, is it intelligence? And then they found out that IQ also only has a 5% indicator. That in fact, stupid CEOs who have very bad performance can make a lot more money than smart CEOs with high performance.
Maybe they have a good personality and charisma and they just get away with it. So.
Well, we're going to find out exactly what that is right after this quick break. So stay with us.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And I would like to wish you a happy Halloween as we head into the Halloween season here. I'm sure there's some costume parties out there as I'm speaking. And we are looking at what it takes to make it in the fashion industry. I have with me Ramona Fazzali, the founder of Malkistan Consulting. Welcome, Ramona.
Thank you.
So I think, you know, before we start, I just want to get a take on what's happening in the global markets. What are we looking at? And we have here Mateen Khalid, the managing director of IPC Global here in the Middle East North African region. Mateen, are you there? Hello?
Yes, Shane, I'm there.
Hi. Thanks for taking a moment, Mateen. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So what's your take on what's happening right now out there?
Well, there's a lot going on. I mean, it's October, which is always the month where markets are at their scariest. In fact, not coincidentally, it was the 85th anniversary of the great crash of 1929 that changed the world.
Uh-oh, so are we in for a trick or treat here?
Well, we did. We had the trick part 2 weeks ago, but for the last 9 sessions, we've been having a treat. The market went down about 10%. I mean, absolute panic, right? Ebola, energy, ISIS, beheadings, viruses, pandemics, the world's falling apart. And then suddenly, the market just shot up another 6%. I'm talking about the U.S. stock market. 6% in the last week or so. So, you know, now the belief is, hey, you know, the rest of the world might be going to hell in a handbasket, but America is doing well. I mean, interest rates are edging up. The U.S. economy is doing really well. The unemployment rate is down below 6%.
So what is all this talk? Because I was just meeting with a bunch of bankers today, and they're all breeding this gloom and doom and saying, oh, Europe is flatlining. U.S. is about to go into a dip. And you're saying we've turned the trick into a treat here.
Yeah, I'm seeing exactly the opposite. I'm saying that after the financial crisis, the U.S. took its medicine, right? I mean, it recapitalized its banking system. It reduced the federal budget deficit. I mean, I'll just give you 2 figures, right? The unemployment rate in Italy and Spain is like 40% for young people. How can you have a normal economy when the younger generation can't even find a job? The problem is that
Uh-huh. I'm not going to say it. I'm just going to leave that alone. No. I was going to say something, but I decided not to. So it's probably bad I didn't.
You know, the real problem in Europe is that the institutions that govern Europe, the central bank, the political institutions, the governments, the trade unions, they have not yet adjusted to the fact that the world is, Europe can't afford its welfare state. It's as simple as that. And as long as that realization doesn't come in, Europe will be haunted by deflation. Today, interest rates in places like Germany and France and Holland are not at like 10-year lows or 20-year lows, but they are at 400-year lows. I mean, think about it. The last time the German 10-year interest rate was this low was when Germany wasn't even a state. It was 300 years ago.
So what does that mean for all the job seekers or professionals out here? Are we going to be riding this gravy train into the bank, or should we be saving our pennies for a rainy day on the horizon?
The UAE economy has benefited from some really unique features, right? On one side, you've got Abu Dhabi, which is a classic petro state. It's an oil and gas generating economy with a massive, massive surplus. You're talking about more than $1 trillion of foreign assets with the Abu Dhabi sovereign funds. And then you've got Dubai, which has become the sort of the logistics and trade and tourism hub. So in a sense, and then the whole country has become a haven for flight capital. Now we are talking about an arc of crisis that extends all the way from Libya to Afghanistan. There's not too many places between these two between Central Asia and North Africa, which have not been affected in some form or the other by civil and political unrest. And what that has meant is that a lot of capital has tried to find investment opportunities here in the UAE. So it's a classic hub, right? I mean, throughout history, you've got these cities that have actually become a sort of a magnet for talent and a magnet for ideas and a magnet for finance. It could have been Venice in the 18th century or Hong Kong as sort of like the gateway to China earlier in this decade. Probably the role played by Singapore in Southeast Asia. And
So in pedestrian terms, it's all good.
Well, I wouldn't say it's all good. You've got a property bubble that's beginning to crack now. I mean, you've got transactions in the real estate market that have just plummeted since the summer. You've got rents that are wobbly now, and in some areas, rents are beginning to fall. You've got, I track the property market really closely, and what you have is in many, many areas, you have a huge amount of speculative demand, right? I mean, a lot of people, you have these chains of what they call themselves underwriters, but what I call Ponzi schemes, where people are buying from developers and then selling on to others, intermediaries, chains of intermediaries, and that could probably cause a correction. The biggest thing that's happening in the world right now, Shane, you got to remember, is the dollar is going up, gold is going down, commodities are going down. Anything related to any kind of commodity apart from coffee, for some reason, because that's related to a drought in Brazil. So when you have periods when the dollar goes up, capital flows pretty much gravitate towards dollar-based economies. Now, we are fine there because, we are a dollar-based economy. Dirham is linked to the dollar. But other emerging markets are going to, people from, let's say, Asia, from Russia, are going to find it much more expensive to purchase assets in a dollar-based economy, which is us.
Well, so overall, we're a haven for flight capital. We're basically have some good growth indicators, but there is a little bit of a trouble from an overheated real estate sector.
I think you'd be right. It's nothing like 2008. It's not, you don't have that kind of leverage. You don't have that kind of involvement of the banking system. But you could see a cyclical correction. I think we are in the early stages of one on the asset side, on the property market.
What about the local equity markets? Are there any picks out there we should be picking up?
I'm really reluctant to recommend anything right now because everything has met my targets, right? I mean, I had a sort of a target of, 11 dirhams or so on Imar, but that was, way back from 2011 when it was 4 dirhams. And I think right now the local equity market is, in most cases, fully valued. There is there is a case in some there is a case for some banks, because you know they do give you a good dividend yield. So as long as your holding period is long enough, you should be all right. And some of these banks, specifically First Gulf Bank, are basically good growth vehicles. They're growing at a much faster pace than, let's say, Standard Chartered or Barclays. So I think that there could be an opportunity there. But again, that's not my area of interest. I really think the biggest opportunity in the world is in healthcare. I think the world's population, especially in the richer countries, is aging. And there's just a new technology sort of, Silicon Valley is just absolutely agog with new teams, like new cures for oncology, various forms of cancers. The genetic basis of medicine is now coming in. Yeah, the immune system is now becoming a weapon to cure cancer, and that means some unbelievable things are happening in the biotechnology area.
I read that there right now, if you're born today, you're going to live over 100. I think they're predicting that the Japanese children born right now will live to 107, and the Americans will live to 104. These are studies from London Business School, latest research.
Yeah.
And they basically come down to your life expectancy is increasing by 2.5 years every decade, which works out now to 6 hours a day. So as these populations are aging, they're also living longer. So it's kind of a bit of a conundrum that's going to make it even worse.
Exactly. Well, you know, the conundrum is that let's take something age-related illnesses, dementia, Alzheimer's, right? You basically have this disease, which at this point in time is incurable. There is no cure for Alzheimer's. And the onset of Alzheimer's can set, I think I'm probably going senile myself, but it can start in late middle age, or mid-middle age, like let's say in the mid-40s, early stages. But then you can end up, statistically speaking, Alzheimer's patients can end up living 20 to 30 years after the onset of the disease. So you have a situation where the entire baby boom and the baby boom generation, i.e. people born in the 1950s and 1960s, could by 2025, 2030, you'll have millions of Alzheimer's patients all over the world. And who's going to take care of them? That is going to bankrupt healthcare systems all over the world, right?
Even in wealthy countries. Probably might make a few millionaires as well, on the other hand, I'm sure.
It's going to make a few billionaires, Shane. Yeah. It's going to make a few billionaires. This is an area I'm really passionate about, and I'm sort of watching it every day. There are companies right now that have the potential not to go up double or triple, but to go up 100x, right? Never underestimate the resilience of the human spirit. So these are the new Facebooks and Googles of the world that are being spawned, really, and in a petri dish, literally, right? So biotechnology, you were talking about aging. I was talking to a guy who was an MD as well as a Rhodes Scholar the other day. I was having dinner with him, and he was literally telling me that they have right now the technology to reduce the aging process in cells, right, and so the molecular structure, with the result that at least if you're rich enough, you could pay, theoretically speaking, to live not to 100, but several hundred. Now, what does that do? That has an impact on everything in human history, on the cosmology of the human race, right? How we are taught to think of a place in the universe, and it has an impact on theology, on philosophy, on politics, and economics, and technology. Now, it's just unfathomable, some of the things that are going on.
So it's the beginning of the revolution.
Markets. Yeah, I think it's way more than the beginning of the revolution. I think we are in the revolution.
Well, Metin, and you never cease to amaze us with your insights and vast knowledge. I want to thank you so much for just taking a moment to give us a ring and give us a peek into what's happening in these global markets.
Hey, thank you, Shane. Thank you. You know, they used to say knowledge is power. I would amend that by saying right now knowledge is power, point.
Okay, have a great one. Cheers. Thanks, Metin.
Bye. Good night.
That was Metin Khaled, Managing Director for IPC Global, one of the monetary geniuses of the region. So, Unfortunately, we didn't. We forgot to ask him what his take on the fashion market was.
Yeah,
so sorry.
That Ramona. Would be interesting to hear. But
you were just absorbing everything
yes,
in
it
there.
It was so interesting.
They were like, "What does a handbag for a 200-year-old lady look like?" I could see that running through your mind.
Yeah, it was very interesting, especially that the U.S. market is doing quite well, and U.S. has always been very, very important for the fashion industry. So. This is a good sign.
This is where, how does that work? The way it's supposedly made in Europe but bought in the U.S. I mean, how did they get that together? But I was also supposed to answer the question: what's the number one determining factor for your salary or compensation from the study that came from Stanford? I have few audience members asking for what it is. Unfortunately, we have to take a quick break. We're going to be right back, and I'll be answering all those questions in just a second, so stay with us.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. This is Shane Phillips, and I'm here with Ramona Fazeli, the founder of Malkistan Consulting. Ramona, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
Well, that was a good insight that we had from Mateen Khalid, the managing director for IPC Global. I think he said everything's looking pretty good except for Europe and the real estate market, but he said it much better. I call him he's like an economic poet when you hear him talk. It's just like transfixes you. You don't really know what he's saying, but you know that if you did understand it, you would make a lot of money. But you were just saying people should read the New York Times, even if you're in fashion, because everything...
Yes.
Influences fashion.
Yes, everything. I try to preach this also to my students because I'm a part-time lecturer at the Esmond Fashion University. So I'm trying to explain to them that everything that happens in the world, economic-wise or political, everything is linked together. So it will also influence their business sector. For instance, the fashion sector is very much... dependent on certain nationalities, on certain on tourism, and once these tourists stop coming to your country or stop spending on your luxury goods, you will stand in the store and have nothing to do, basically.
So, just for people to follow your path, you after you finished your degrees, you started working for Gucci.
No, that was a part-time job when I was doing my bachelor, master's. I used to go after school and work in the store, basically, as a part-time sales assistant. And I was very lucky after that to become a fashion buyer for Prada for a few years. And then fate drove me to Dubai. It was more love, not fate, actually.
Ooh, love.
Yes, love brought me to Dubai.
Oh.
I was supposed to go to Rome, but love brought me to Dubai.
Who is the...
He's happily married and has kids, and we are very good friends, but I'm happy that I ended up to be
You
in
moved
Dubai.
Across country because you had your eye on a particular man?
Well, he had his eye on me, and he convinced me to come to Dubai, so yes.
And then he bailed out once you got here?
No, I think I bailed out because I loved it. He moved then to Iran, and I wasn't ready to go to Iran and live in Iran. And I like Dubai. It was very challenging in the beginning because it was a cultural shock, even though I'm Iranian from the origin. But when you grow up in Germany, you have still the German mentality. Very
so you
much.
Celebrate Oktoberfest?
Yeah,
do you have those leather shorts? I can't picture you in
the dirndl. It's called dirndl for women. Yeah.
Yes, do you have a dirndl?
No, I'm not that. I mean, my sister has. Yeah, my sister.
Your
is
sister
more,
does.
Yeah, she loves Oktoberfest.
So you're not a true German then?
Not really. I don't like beer even. So it's. I like sauerkraut for all the Germans out there. But yes, yeah, so I came to Dubai. I started with Shalhoub Group and took over Valentino Middle East and also buying for the multi-brand stores for 4 years. And after 4 years, I moved to Bin Hendi Group, which is a local company here. And I was the general manager for their fashion division, looking after brands Hugo Boss, Brioni, very much men-dominated sector. And it was a good breeze to work with men. Mainly, it was mainly working with men. And yes, after that, I was consulting an investment company here.
Why do you point it out that it's men or make that distinction?
Because it was quite fun. It was very different than working with women brands and with women in general. It was all the stuff that I had, 80% were men. And you feel very much protected as well as a woman to have so many men around you. And men's brands, if you believe it or not, but they grew faster than, or they are growing faster than women's business, because the women's market is so saturated where the male market has still room. So it's still room for them to grow. Compared to the women's business, they are growing 16%, where the women's sector is growing by 6% yearly. So you can see the opportunities out there also to start a men's line brand if there are any talents out there.
You almost sound like you prefer working with men than women.
I think every woman prefer working with men. You just get away with everything, and they are, I mean, you are like a little princess at the end of the day. You want water, your stuff will bring you water. I'm not saying that they are my servants, but it's easier, yes.
So in fact, when, you know, women are trying to get promoted in the workplace, it's actually the other women that stop them from being promoted, not the men.
I don't think so, because
you say you have to promote someone, you're like, no, I'd rather have the man on my team.
No,
it's,
I have to say,
I work with
someone like Inji Shalhoub for 4 years, and she was my mentor. So she was the greatest role model, or she is still the greatest role model that I look up to. So no, I think here also we learn to work together, but yes, it's a cliche that women can't work together. I know.
Oh,
you would love to hear that now from me. I know.
Now, why do you choose this lady as your mentor? You say she's the greatest. What really captured?
She is just very, very smart, and she has built an empire as well. So if you see that someone has achieved something in life, even through obstacles, then you look up to them. And this is someone that I look up to.
And so you're out to build your empire now.
I hope so, yes.
Well, you're in the right city, I'm sure, to do that. So you were the general manager for Bin Hindi.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like working with an entrepreneur like Bin Hindi?
Well, his vision never stops. That's the part that fascinated me each time when we were sitting with him himself, because he never stopped to dream and to have a vision. And you don't find that everywhere anymore. I mean, having someone sitting there for 30 years and still having new ideas and new visions is quite interesting. I mean, I meet younger people and they don't dream that big. And I think it takes a lot of courage to dream big and actually to implement it and follow up on the implementation as well.
But then you quit.
I quit, yes.
So why did you quit?
I really wanted to have my own company. Like, I think a lot of people in Dubai, maybe we think that it's easier. And to be fair with Dubai, it's easier to have your own company than in Europe. In Europe, it takes a long time, tax system. But then when you work with a lot of great people and you learn so much from them that you think, you know, I believe I can do it out there. So there is a time always also for a woman, I think, where she has to make a decision and to put priorities in life. At that time, I was working a lot. I was traveling a lot. I basically had no life. And I didn't take time for myself. And I thought it's time to think about myself and start.
So now you have your own company and you work 10 times more than you did, than you did when you worked for someone else.
Well, but it's worth it. I mean, every day when you wake up, you know why you are waking up. You know why you are doing
it. Because if you don't, you go bankrupt. It's
exactly.
Fear.
And also because you like what you do. I mean, you have so many ideas every day. I have 3-4 ideas at the same time, and I just don't have the manpower to do all of them. But I have so many ideas, and I don't need approvals from anyone. It's not that I go with my gut feeling, which I usually do. But I have to go and get the facts right, if this is right for the market or not. But It's more fun. Honestly, it's more fun.
You have so many ideas, but you don't get to do them because you're waiting for your visa approval for your staff, and then you have to pick up the office supplies.
No,
and then
you have PROs to do that. You
do
have you? PROs to do that.
Oh,
yeah, that's
big
again.
Now.
I mean, in Dubai, we are a bit too spoiled. I think everything is being done for you. Where in Germany, I remember one day I just freaked out because my maid didn't come, and I called my mom, and she said, in Germany, we didn't even have a maid. Can you please clean your apartment? I said, okay. So I did it. But here, yes, we are a bit too spoiled, I think.
It's a bit daunting. You know, the other day I spilled some milk on the floor and the maid wasn't there. I was traumatized.
You see?
it's bad. But,
it's really bad.
This is a story of Ramona Fazeli, a founder of Malkasten Consulting. She quit a general manager job in one of the top fashion brands here in Dubai to pursue her dream. She took a jump into the deep end, and this is her story. We're going to be right back.
Dubai Eye 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I want to wish you all a happy Halloween and say a big thank you to our sponsor, the ICAEW, the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. They really make it possible for us to bring these leadership message to you. And coming up after, in just a few minutes, we're going to have a CFO panel, a chief financial officer. We got two of the top dogs here in town that are going to look at what it takes to become a CFO. What are some of the key milestones? What's the difference between a controller and a CFO, and how to unlock your career and take it to the next level if you want to be the top gun in the financial game? But before we do that, we are hearing the last bit of story from Ramona Fazeli. She is the founder of Malkasten Consulting and a former general manager of Bin Hindi Fashion. She is telling us what it takes to make it in the fashion game. Ramona, welcome back to Ion Critters. It's great to have you here. It's been interesting listening to your story. You dropped out of law school to work in like a textile factory or something.
It's not a textile factory. It's a textile engineering university and very well reputable.
But to your parents at the time, that's probably what they felt it was.
Yes, they were happy that I had the engineering title at least. So
okay.
I wasn't a designer then, so they were quite happy.
So, you know, you've worked in like three different countries. You know, you've quit. Now you start your own business. You've managed over 300 people. You've managed some of the top brands. You've dealt with some of the most difficult situations someone can deal with. What really in your life to date has been the biggest challenge or your darkest moment, and how did you get through it?
Well, the darkest moment was recently. It was 3 months ago when you think that your life is perfect. I mean, you're going out there to live your dream, and you leave everything behind. You take the courage to actually take the step and say goodbye to a great job in a great company with a great salary. And then you say, I'm going to go out there and make it on my own. And when you're something happens, something unexpected that you can't control, private life. You never can control your private life. It's always more your professional life that you can control. So when something happens there and you suddenly, especially me, being, as I said, a bit too German and too robotic and planning everything ahead, being quite lost in something that I have no control over, that was my biggest challenge. Because what happens is, yes, you have your friends to support you, you have your family, everybody's talking to you, everybody's trying to help you. But at the end of the day, or just 2 weeks ago, I had to realize that it's only me who can help myself. There is no one who will come and give me anything on a silver platter. I have to get back and fight my battle by myself. And I'm in a great city with great people, with a great support. So that was my greatest challenge as a human being, to actually stand up and do it all over again. And I had to see, actually, once you develop a positive attitude towards problems or challenges, everything around you changed. And I have witnessed that, and I have seen that it can happen. It's something that comes from within you. So that was my biggest challenge, and I'm happy to be back on track to make it happen again, that my projects are rolling again, that I made it. I made the decision that I wanted so badly that I had to basically wake up every day with a goal.
Well, I think Andy Grove said, you know, you need to own your career like an entrepreneur. Nobody owes you anything. Nobody
yes.
owes you a career. No one's going to give you any handouts.
Yes.
You have to get in the driver's seat and make it happen. You're a brand and you have to build that. So many people sit in the back seat and make excuses as to why they can't take that next step. And I think you, especially starting your own company, realize there's no cavalry that's going to come in. There's no one to escalate an issue to. You have to really drive it forward on your own.
And you have to know what you want. Once you know what you want, or what's more important, I mean, you want just to sit there and daydream about what you want, or you want to really go out there and make it happen. And it sounds a bit cliche, but it's really true, because hard work and will bring you farther. If you put an extra 10%, no, only 10%, I'm not saying more than that, every day you will see the difference. You will feel the difference, and you will feel more confident. You will be able to deal with difficult situations. Nothing is easy. In the beginning, I have also to realize that having your own business doesn't mean that you will be successful from day one only because you have the courage, the vision, and the talent. No, you will fail. You will fail probably 10 times till it works. But if you are persistent and consistent in what you say, and if you can deliver what you promise, which is the most important in starting your own business, because a lot of people tend to overpromise just to get clients, for instance, or just to make people happy. But if you actually can deliver what you promise, you will always have your customer loyalty, or you can build a customer loyalty.
Well, what's your final piece of advice for anyone who wants to make it in the fashion industry?
Be persistent again. I mean, I have sometimes people who knock at my door 10 times till they get hired. But know what you want and be honest with yourself, what your talents are, where you're good at. It's not only enough to dream it. I mean, I meet on a daily basis people who are telling me, I want to start a fashion brand, but they don't even have the education in design. There are a lot of good people, talented people out there. You need to work hard, even if you don't have the right education, go and go to a school and do what it takes to make you competitive. There are a lot of competitors out there. You have to be excellent. It doesn't, it's not enough anymore to be good. In this economical situation, it's not, I mean, the world is not Dubai. The world is bigger than Dubai. You need to make it everywhere. You need to be able to keep up with everybody out there. So be honest where you're good at, and be persistent and be confident. And but I have to say this also in the fashion business, because it's not said enough, be nice to people.
Well, Ramona, well, thank you so much for coming on Iron Careers, and we wish you
thank
all
you.
The best of luck with your new business.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Shay.